Hello and welcome back. It's been a week that's seen the first sit-down interview for Kamala Harris as US presidential contender. After a headline-grabbing summer where she's dominated the American media landscape, we look at the reinvention of Kamala from gaffe-prone veep to self-assured campaign candidate. We'll also look at Donald Trump's maneuvers to regain the spotlight.
She didn't look like a leader to me, I'll be honest. I don't see her negotiating with President Xi of China. I don't see her with Kim Jong-un.
It's been a week that's seen the Russian-born CEO of the messaging app, Telegram, arrested at an airport outside Paris, placed under formal investigation, banned from leaving France. Pavel Durov is alleged to have enabled the proliferation of illicit activity and sexual exploitation of children. It's an attack on free speech, says Moscow, a country that banned Facebook and Instagram and severely restricted access to YouTube. We'll discuss the political and ethical implications.
We are a country where there is a separation of powers, where our rules and the rule of law are overseen by independent judges.
And unless you've been off the world away, you'll have seen the news from the Gallagher brothers this week. It is time to shake off your parka, get a cigarette lighter ready to wave to live forever. They're getting the band back together. The guns have fallen silent, came the joint message. The stars have aligned, weeks of rumours true. Oasis, one of Britain's biggest bands, are going on tour 15 years after their notorious fallout in Paris. The return of Cool Britannia. Because maybe you're gonna be the one that saves me. And after all, you're my wonderwall. Welcome back to the world this week. La rentrée, the return, sort of, in this purgatory between the end of summer and back to work. We will hopefully keep you in holiday spirits with this week's panel, who are mad for it and half the world away in the US capital. Fraser Jackson, France 24's Washington correspondent. Fraser, Blur or Oasis?
I'm more of an Oasis fan myself. I must say I'm enjoying all of the little references there, Gavin. But yeah, I'm trying to get tickets myself, so holding out hope.
Elizabeth Pinault in the studio, Reuters political correspondent based in Paris. Oasis or Blur, Elizabeth?
Let's say Oasis. And I have many new enemies.
Let's also bring in Philip Moreau, Chevrolet political strategist. Hello, Philip, president of the MCBG Consulting. Philip, same question, Oasis, Blur?
Oasis, that's pretty much the only thing I can play on the guitar. So it's
Wonderwall.
Yeah, that's beautiful music.
Doug Herbert is a music connoisseur, France 24's international affairs consultant. Tell me.
Angèle all the way.
Sitting on the fence, ruining France 24's snap
poll. That was off the table.
Forced for a choice.
Staying on the fence.
Okay, well, I'm guessing Oasis have won the most contentious musical question of modern times, the battle of British bands, according to, well, three and a bit to one, maybe. There is going to be plenty of talk tonight, so let's begin in the US. Thursday night in the state of Georgia, Kamala Harris gave a first sit-down interview as contender for US presidency alongside running mate Tim Walz. The Democrats have dominated the summer headlines, a welcome new lease of life for them since Joe Biden's decision not to run over concerns of his age and ability. In the 6 weeks since the candidates changed, there's been a reluctance to give any interviews. Maybe gaffes made in her last major sit-down interview as vice president, some speculated, plus praise just from sticking to the teleprompter in a scripted speech at the Democratic convention, enough to create splashes across papers, broadcasts, social media, doing what they wanted to do, shifting the spotlight away from the daily affairs of rival Donald Trump. So this, the first time she was able to be directly questioned about detail of her plan rather than broad brushstrokes. Behind the scenes, journalists told she'd talk in so-called huddles, short off the record, off-camera briefings, but according to them, and maybe 70 seconds each time was all they got. So, CNN, that was the interview of her choice this week, and here's a snippet of the half-hour sit-down with Dawna Bash.
I made that clear on the debate stage in 2020 that I would not ban fracking. As vice president, I did not ban fracking. As president, I will not ban fracking.
What made you change that position at the time?
Well, let's be clear. My values have not changed. I believe it is very important that we take seriously what we must do to guard against what is a clear crisis in terms of the climate.
Let's go straight to Washington. Let's bring in Fraser Jackson. Fraser, talk of pancakes and bacon as well. It seemed to be gaffe-free. What's your reading from it?
I think this is one of those situations where journalists and people in DC had put a lot more emphasis onto this interview than was actually needed. And I also don't think it was really helped by the fact that the Harris campaign haven't done more media in the last couple of days. I think if they'd kind of, you know, flooded the zone is one of the phrases that the White House likes to use for these kind of events. If they flooded the zone and got out a lot of interviews with local media, lots of different national networks, I don't think so much importance would have been put on this one interview with CNN. Having said that, I don't really think it moved the needle either way. I don't think Kamala Harris really gained any new followers from this interview. I don't think it really did her any damage either. I think it was a very steady away interview. She didn't really say much beyond what we've already heard, especially when you look at the policy points that she was talking about. It was very much going over the same ones that we've heard about, you know, building the new houses, helping the middle class, price gouging and those kind of things. Nothing really massively new on that. But perhaps the only real new thing that came out of it was when she was asked whether she would have a Republican in her cabinet, to which she said yes, she would. She believed that a broad range of opinions is what best serves the American people. But yeah, I think this is more of a tale of pressure and importance being put on this by the media and by the people in DC rather than what the actual electorate will get out of this interview. So nothing really major here out of this interview, but a steady away interview for Kamala Harris nevertheless.
Philip, nothing major from the interview. From a consulting perspective, was this about, given the electric summer that she'd had, that there's probably more to lose because people were waiting for a gaffe than there was to gain here?
Yes, she's more to lose now because she's at the top of her game, and she gained a lot of ground in very limited times, which is amazing. Nobody expected that. And so I think their strategy is to be on the quiet side for a while, let things, you know, happen, and we will see in a few weeks when it's time to attack again. I think it's well managed. The campaign is brilliant. They took over the freedom from the Republicans. It was a Republican-only theme. They took it and they brought it to the Democratic side, which is amazing. She's the candidate without any, you know, nobody is against that. And she did that in, what, 2 weeks? And she's leading in the polls, so I think everything is fine. And I think the attacks against her are not taking really, they are not really hurting her image for the moment. And she has a brilliant VP, contrary to Trump, who has a very embarrassing VP, you know, a VP that he would like to replace by Elon Musk. It's not possible, but if he could, he would, I guess.
That's very interesting. Elizabeth talking about nothing sticking on Kamala just yet, despite attempts from Donald Trump and her at the top of this wave, perhaps, 60-odd days to go until the election. But don't forget, listen to Fraser talk about how, you know, wasn't much of a revelation that we got, but she would have been sitting down with media strategists for hours, if not days before, playing out all of those questions. Maybe you can overbake that.
You said it. Well, what a contrast between the Chicago show and this, the quiet interview on CNN, saying almost nothing, boring, said Donald Trump, but she was right to do so. And of course, the strategy, in the two coming months, just 60 days is so short. Every image, every word will count, of course, and she was very balanced on every matter. For instance, on the Middle East, she said, well, Israel has got the right to defend itself and too many Palestinians, innocent Palestinians killed. On that matter, she was very careful on every matter. And I think she was right to be almost boring, like Donald Trump said. But still, we know that whatever happens in November, the result will be very tight. So every second, every image counts. And she must be very careful. And of course, we are still waiting for her program. So that will be the next step.
Doug, do we know who the real Kamala Harris is yet?
Well, I mean, look, do we know who she is going to be as president? She's right now treading a fine line. She's still vice president, right? She is still Joe Biden's vice president. And I think she genuinely does respect Joe Biden. And she...
No, but more than that, Doug. People want to know...
We're learning.
What's the essence of...
We're learning. Remember one thing about Kamala Harris? She was essentially kept in the closet for many, many years. The Biden administration, Joe Biden himself, had a firm determination to run. And it really didn't even become part of the narrative that this scenario would be unfolding until a month ago. So she was not groomed, so to speak, for this role. She has come at it really almost out of nowhere. She has a steep right now process introducing herself to the American people curve, if you will. That's no surprise. What I've saying, given that, given how much she was sort of kept in the backdrop and sort of forced prevented from forging her own persona throughout the past 3.5 years of this Biden administration, it's remarkable how much we do now know about her in a remarkably short time. And I suspect that that's going to become even more compressed in the 66 days left until the election. We're going to learn a lot more about her. The Republicans are going to try to make sure in shaping the narrative that we learn all the wrong things about her or very negative things about her. But I'll say one thing. The latest polls, I was looking at them before I came. Say what you will about the polls. Right now in the national polling averages, she's about 2 to 3 to 5 points ahead. In the key battleground states, we know what they are, the Michigans, the Pennsylvanias, the Wisconsin, Sunbelt states, the Georgia, Nevada, Arizonas. It's very tight. It's neck and neck and a tie in some of those states. How that's going to shake out in the days to come, anything can happen. But right now I'll say it is remarkable in such a short time that she's introduced herself to the extent that she has and that these polls are showing what they're showing.
Well, let's take a quick look at that poll because I think you're quite right that Kamala Harris is a percentage point or so ahead, 46-47% to, let's have a look at this. So 49% here. This is updated today, 46% to Donald Trump. This is the New York Times poll. Fraser, talk to us about Donald Trump here, his strategy. He's got in trouble this week taking and filming in a cemetery at Arlington, which is not allowed as part of the campaign coverage. But before I get your point, let's have a listen to what Donald Trump had to say about Kamala's interview.
Sitting behind that desk, this massive desk, and she didn't look like a leader to me, I'll be honest. I don't see her negotiating with President Xi of China. I don't see her with Kim Jong-un like we did with Kim Jong-un. So we're going to have to see what happens.
He does have a very particular way of saying China. Fraser, what do you make of that?
I think, you know, Donald Trump at the moment is still struggling to get a handle on how to effectively combat Kamala Harris. We know that he doesn't do very well with females in particular and women of colour in particular as well. So the fact that this is now his running opposition, I think he's still trying to get a handle on that. He has, in the last couple of weeks, basically thrown everything at the wall to see what sticks. And, you know, there have been many different nicknames. Normally, he's quite good at choosing one nickname and making it stick, but he hasn't really had the same success with Kamala Harris as he had with some of his Republican contenders for the nomination in the past, and even the Democratic opponents as well. So I think Donald Trump at the moment is still trying to figure out the messaging that he is trying to push against Kamala Harris. And I think there's also a bit of a disagreement between Donald Trump himself and his camp. His campaign want him to stay on message, to push the border, to push the economic message. They think that is what resonates with voters. And we've heard as well from the campaign that they are trying to get him into smaller venues and to get him to stay on script and to get him to stay on that economic message. It must be said, the rally that he did on Monday where he was on script, it was a very low energy affair, which when you consider some of the Donald Trump rallies that we've seen in the past, really was a million miles away from that. And I think there's a real push and pull here where in some ways Donald Trump is his own worst enemy when it comes to his campaign, because he wants and he likes to go off message and to rail against those people that he sees as having transgressed him in some ways. But we know that that is not what resonates with voters. It resonates with his base, but that base has always been there and will always be there. What he needs to do to win is to enlarge the tent. That is exactly what Nikki Haley said he needed to do, and something that he hasn't really done since Kamala Harris took over as the Democratic nominee. So it's going going to be interesting in the next couple of weeks to see whether Donald Trump can listen to his advisors and get on message. Yeah. But knowing the man as we do and having seen what he's done over the last 10 years, that is unlikely to happen, it must be said.
Yeah, I saw Donald Trump was doing interviews over the summer with YouTubers, talking about MMA, kind of taking an unusual approach where it's hard to gauge where those voters are coming from, but he's trying different avenues. Just a quick one with you, because I know you've sat there for the Kamala press conferences. Doug mentioned a minute ago, trying to sense of the real Kamala Harris. I asked him that question. I wonder if it's pertinent to you as well. Have you met her one-on-one? And what's your sense of covering press conferences with her as well?
I've been in the room with her. I've you know, not met her personally one-on-one, but I've been in small situations with her where we've had either press gaggles or she's been with by the side of Joe Biden and things like that. But I've not had a real one-on-one with her per se. But I will say, you know, I think the messaging around who she is, a lot of that was successfully done during the DNC last week, during the Democratic National Convention, where we had 4 days, basically, of people coming to give character witnesses, coming forward to give their testimonials as to the Kamala Harris that they know and love, whether that was Doug Emhoff or, you know, childhood friends. I think it was successfully done, and it needed to be done because, as Doug correctly pointed out, we didn't really know her that much during the Biden administration. She was always kind of just waiting in the wings, whereas now she's in the center stage. The limelight is on her, and all these questions are now going to be important. So, you know, her background as a prosecutor, her background as the Attorney General of California, the you know, the even further than that, the background of her as the daughter of a single mother, an immigrant to this country, is something that they're going to try to push forward to really engage with those voters in middle America who might be on the fence as to whether they should go Kamala Harris's way or Donald Trump's way. And they're hoping that that, you know, middle America message is what resonates with voters.
Well, not a one-on-one yet. I know, for example, Anthony Scaramucci, formerly of Trump's advisor, sometimes watches France 24, The World This Week. Maybe other Democrats are listening. Fraser Jackson needs an interview one-on-one. We need to get a sense. In the meantime, Philly, take a look at this bit of footage this week. This is Delaware. Wednesday, a glimpse of beachside Biden. The president relaxing with a few books in his bag, beats a day in the office. Let's take a look at this. Wanted him to do, Philip, several weeks ago.
Yes, but he didn't want to do it. So that's nice to see him taking some days off, I guess.
What's your view when it comes to the remaining time that he has? And if you were part of the Kamala...
He must be in the campaign. He must be campaigning for Kamala Harris.
Central?
Yes, of course, because he's the former president. He's the acting president. He's president. He's the acting president. He needs to be there. He will give her credibility. He will give her also likability, lots of things that she needs, and she doesn't have the time to acquire. So he is essential to the campaign. He's resigned, so he's shown some sense of responsibility. That's even better for Kamala Harris that he would be there because he decided not to go, to let her go. He was very mature in his decision, and I'm not talking about age. He's been responsible. Not a lot of politicians would, you know, do that. And in France, we would love to have such politicians that, you know, decide to let things go politically and let others take charge. It would be a good thing, actually.
Well, you tears up nicely, but briefly, Doug... What's your reading of the optics there with beachside Biden? Is that by chance or could nothing be chance like that? Is that set up?
Look, I mean, in American politics, the optics are everything. You know, the spin doctors are everywhere. The campaigners are there. He has his teams of communications advisors. Nothing's completely by coincidence. I think, though, he's trying to give her right now that stage. We saw it already, you know, on that after he gave the opening night keynote address at the Democratic National Convention. He retreated. He went on holiday after that. He was basically, you know, it was his valedictory address in a sense. He's still president. But, you know, his goodbye, I'm handing. Handing over, it was symbolic handing over the keys to Kamala Harris. And this is his way of now saying the stage is yours. I put my full confidence in you and use it as you will. And just picking up on what was just said, yeah, he remains very popular in the Democratic Party, and even more so now that he has taken this very mature decision, perhaps unorthodox for a politician of his rank, to withdraw himself from public life. It is really boosted his legacy and has given him sort of a new lease on life in the esteem of many in the Democratic Party and beyond.
For the next chapter. Well, here in France, Monday, an announcement from President Macron. Was it to be the white smoke above the Élysée Palace? We were waiting for an agreement, finally, on a new prime minister. 7 weeks since the elections were won by the left-wing alliance. No, no smoke, no fire. A refusal to appoint a prime minister that had been put forward by the left-wing bloc. Let's take you back before the beachy haze of summer holidays. Remember the gamble taken by the president in calling the snap vote, betting on the French public to make the, quote, right decision in the wake of the National Rally's success in EU elections? Well, it was the leftist New Popular Front which won, not enough to govern. Let's show you those election results. We get a sense, well, we can't show you them. I don't think the gallery's going to show you nada right now, but it wasn't enough for a majority. So it was Lucie Castet, who was the name put forward by the left, for PM, 37-year-old, largely unknown economist, who appears to be continuing now as a largely unknown 37-year-old economist. Non, 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 said Monsieur Macron. Why? Well, a significant factor is Marine Le Pen, Jordan Bardella of the far right, who came second and said they would put forward a vote of no confidence if he installed a leftist government. So what to do? Tuesday, President Macron met with a group of independent legislators to start a new round of talks. He'll continue meeting conservatives. He's met some centre-right Republicans. Apparently that didn't go very well. So here we are, extreme left and the far right, France Unbowed, apparently not invited. So let's bring in Elisabeth Pinault. This is easier probably to untie a Gordian knot right now than choose a prime minister, isn't it?
Yes, you're right. We may have a new prime minister by the end of the weekend. Or not. We may not have him.
There is a new name.
There are different names coming out of the journalist, Observateur, but not coming from the Élysée, no. And even the advisors do not know. They told us at the beginning of the week that it should be this week. And, well, this is Friday and nothing happened. And, well, yesterday Emmanuel Macron was in Serbia and he said that there was a pressure, and he was, of course, he had a question about that, and he said that he was working on it day and night, and that, yeah, it should arrive sometime. There are a few names. For instance, Bernard Cazeneuve, yes. Former prime minister. He seems ready for the job. He wants it. Which is not so easy, is quite well known by the French people because he was the interior ministry, that was under François Hollande presidency. He was the interior ministry during the 2015 attacks, for instance, so people remember him at the time. And he was during five months prime minister. He could come back, but again, he says he's ready for the job. He says that he didn't talk to Macron and it could be, of course, somebody else. It could be Xavier Bertrand. He's from the right. Bernard Cazeneuve is coming from the left, but he's against the extreme left. That's an important point. Xavier Bertrand is coming from the right and is, like we say, Gaulliste social, meaning that he's okay. He could gather some people from the left. He's the president of the Région Hauts-de-France, a region in the north of France.
You talk about President Macron in the last couple of days in Belgrade. Let's hear what he had to say about these meetings. And also, not just the search for the prime minister, but let's hear a key part here is meeting with the centre-rights, the Gaullists, the Les Républicains. This is the Les Républicains' reaction to their latest meeting about finding a prime minister.
We did not choose a strategy of chaos, and we decided to try to contribute to finding solutions. Unfortunately, this meeting was disappointing. No new position, no real structured plan for the French people, no vision of what a government program would be for the coming months.
Believe me, I'm doing everything I can day and night, and I've been doing it for weeks, even if you haven't necessarily seen it, to come up with the best solution for the country.
So, Philip, what do you consider the actual deadline? Is there a deadline here?
No. First of all, this is not an agreement. We are not waiting for an agreement. We are waiting for a decision, not by a certain number of people, by one man. And this is very peculiar to French politics. And also the political parties are not mature enough in France to be able to gather, to talk between themselves, and try to decide in lieu of the president. So they are all coming to l'Élysée Palace, to the president, expecting him to choose someone. It's a level of unmaturity, if you will, that is unprecedented in French politics. So he's playing the field because everyone allows him to play the field. Why wouldn't he? I mean, he's lost basically two elections in a huge margin. These elections were really, really lost, and he's still the winner of the game. Yeah. We don't know exactly how it will end. What we see in the polls is a decline in the trust, in the faith of French people in the political parties to an unprecedented level. And the level of pessimism, which is also unprecedented, 34% of the French population is pessimistic. Because of that, and we have economic impacts on investments in France, the future money, if you want, the money to come, is not coming. Because of that, the economical situation is blocked. So, well, I don't know.
So you have a peculiar situation as you talk about French law. The president is solely responsible for naming the prime minister. No obligation to choose somebody. No legal deadline. Parliament can't bring
down
the caretaker government.
It's like he's playing tennis with himself for 2 weeks, two months.
There's something that reminds me a little bit of Brexit in a different way. I remember covering Brexit every day. And there was these deadlines set by the EU, which came and went. Now, people in France and French papers talk about October the 1st as a draft budget law. Is there pressure? Could that be enough of a deadline, Elizabeth, too?
Yes, well, there is the budget deadline is a deadline, kind of, because the Gabriel Attal's government prepared something just in case. So there is a government, kind of government, and there is a budget ready.
Kind of
more
budget.
Or less. Yeah. But, Emmanuel Macron knows that. Well, every time he had to pick up Prime Minister, he waited a long time, 3 weeks. This is, of course, 2 months instead of 3 weeks. But, I think it's going to come some maybe next week, maybe this weekend, maybe next week.
You're optimistic. But, Philip, do you agree? Are you optimistic
as
that?
Prime Minister is something, and then he will have to name a government that could take 1 or 2 weeks or more.
Yeah, it could be during the weekend. We just don't know.
Yes, we just don't know. But why waiting? We don't understand.
I got Brexit wrong. I got Trump wrong. I get it all wrong. So actually, just take the opposite of whatever I say, likely to be right.
What do you think?
But look, first of all, I think we have to underscore one thing. There's this sort of narrative that's set in among many people that somehow the left-wing coalition has first dibs on naming a prime minister, that by virtue of the fact that they got the most seats of the three blocks that got roughly an equal number of seats from these elections, somehow the left-wing alliance has the first right to appoint. There's no such rule. Nothing's written in the Constitution to that extent. And you're right. Emmanuel Macron he's not obligated to pick a prime minister from the party that won the most seats. It's been much easier in recent French political history to do this because under Mitterrand, you had two instances in which a prime minister had to be chosen. There was an absolute majority. It was a much more sort of obvious choice. You had one under Chirac as well. So in the past three circumstances, you had nothing approaching the situation. Just remember one thing. The pure math of it is that the left-wing alliance came away with 193 seats. Sure, it won the most seats in these legislative elections. It was still 96 seats short of an absolute majority. That is a long cry away. So this is why you get into other things. I heard one French commentator say this week, I think this sums it up really well, that there is a cultural incapacity in France to forge coalitions and to negotiate across ideological divides.
Well, talking about the French commentary, interesting this week, Le Monde newspaper headline commenting that Macron had a responsibility to ensure the stability of the country, saying that if he were to split, Castex, all the other groups would form a majority. If we were to choose Castex, the other groups would form a majority to bring forward a motion of no confidence. So that's why Sophie Castex left the picture. From the left narrative, the Jacobin, Macron and allies still in denial, but it still doesn't change the fact they say that the French people made a clear mandate to the left alliance. I'd be interesting, Fraser, how this is seen from Washington. I mean, there's many plates that are being spun right now. Is it even being noticed that there's a lack of coalition, lack of prime minister?
I think, you know, if you look at it from the White House level, I mean, I think the U.S. is kind of preoccupied with its own drama at the moment. Of course, just over a month ago, we thought we were headed for a Joe Biden and Donald Trump, election. That's completely flipped on its head. You've got to look more at the kind of State Department level for where they are, of course, paying attention to this. France is a key ally to the United States, its oldest ally. And of course, Joe Biden was just in France over a couple of weeks ago to try to, you know, secure this kind of this relationship once again. So it is a key ally, and they are taking note of it. But I think it's obviously not been as followed as closely as it is in France. And it must be said, there is a real sense the difference between, when you look at Congress here in the US, for example, there's a much more of a divide at the moment. But historically, there has been a lot of reaching across the aisle, working between each side to try to get legislation passed. And there is a real sense at the moment in French politics that compromise equals capitulation. That is something that's been interesting to watch from this side of the Atlantic, as for once, French politics makes American politics almost seem mundane, at least up until a month ago.
Yeah, and very interesting to note in the US, there's kind of a happy warrior vibe about the Democratic Convention. Very different sort of, smiles, despite the insults from Trump, whereas here in France, there's a bit clear frustration. Philip, I'm just interested how you see, and I guess it's going to vary greatly, but what is the general public reaction to the position that Emmanuel Macron is in? Is there sympathy for him or frustration?
No sympathy for him. Is really unpopular. Frustration, yes. The French people are turning against their politicians, mainly because they discovered during the Olympic Games that they could be happy without the politicians, that they could find some national pride in spite of their politicians. And I think it will leave a huge question mark. Do we really need these guys? Do we really need to live with that political class? And I think it's kind of like maybe in the UK after the Brexit, there is a question mark about that. And the president has a huge responsibility because he created that situation from nowhere. It was not needed. And it's also blocking, by the way, negotiations at the EU, the fact that the president has done that. It's also blocking our
choosing commissioners.
It weakens our position in the EU, so it has repercussions on the situation of Ukraine. So it's really, really something that pisses people off, if you mind my French. And they are angry when they know about it, but most of the people start not really to care about what the president does or not. Or doesn't do. I mean, his strategy is really to be the only moderate in the field. He has a strategy. He's not stupid. He wants to be the only moderate in the field. If he sees any other moderate, like Lucie Castet on the left side, he will automatically kill that because he wants to be the only one standing in front of the extremes. That is his strategy since it has been his strategy for 7 years. So he sticks to that strategy, and it's very clear. He wants to be the only one. And also, he's ready to sacrifice his own troops, his own allies, his own MPs to that end.
And
he's very individualistic.
But in that sense, from talking to Elizabeth a moment ago about Bernard Cazeneuve, do you think the same would apply there?
Yeah, he's a former socialist prime minister. Of course, it could help because it would divide the Socialist Party along a conservative and not so conservative line. It will be helpful for Emmanuel Macron in order to, be in that central position and kill anything else on the moderate side. And it would be instrumental. The question is, will he accept to do that because he will be instantly hugely unpopular on the left? I mean, really unpopular.
Doug and Elizabeth, that's a good point, actually, because we had this intensity. You were both on the programme when we were covering the elections, the aftermath, where we go from here. And then suddenly, the Olympics, pause. We'll come back to you in a minute. And it's kind of recommencing now as to where this goes. But it kind of doesn't feel that, from your end, let me know if it's different, that the frustration has built anymore. It's the distraction of something else going on for the French public, perhaps. The Olympics. We can do this without the politicians.
Well, people are frustrated and maybe they're fed up with politics, but still, they rose up against the extreme right at the beginning of the summer. That's really what happened. Yeah. So I think French people are a really political people. And Having said that, of course, there were the Olympic Games, the summer, everybody was on holidays. The kids go back to school on Monday. So I think now, time is up.
And let's not forget that the most left of the parties in the left-wing alliance, France Unbowed, La France Insoumise, is calling for people to take to the streets next week on September 7th. So that will be the ultimate test of the la rentrée, as you were talking about at the top of the show, and what the political climate's going to look like, who is going to take part, how big will those protests be, and what sort of impact they will have if we still don't have the name of a new prime minister by then.
It was all not needed. We didn't need that. Mm. Emmanuel Macron did that. He lost the European elections. That's not the end of the world, right? He could live with it. We could live with it. There is no necessity for what he did. So the main question that you have to ask yourself is why on earth did he do that? That's the main question. Since he didn't provide people with a narrative, it will follow him. I think it will weaken his image for years to come if he doesn't provide at least a kind of an answer to that.
Yeah, I think members of his own party were asking him the same question, weren't they? Next, to the curious incident of a Russian-born tech boss in the nighttime at Paris Le Bourget Airport. Pavel Durov, founder and CEO of the messenger app Telegram, arrested last weekend. By Wednesday evening, as the case evolved and more details emerged, the 39-year-old billionaire was facing criminal charges for a wide range of offences, for failing to prevent illicit activity on the app, including sexual exploitation of children, drug trafficking. Moscow accusing France of political foul play. President Macron said it wasn't political. He wasn't even aware of Durov's arrival in France. He spoke to reporters while in Serbia on Thursday.
We are a country where there is a separation of powers, where our rules and the rule of law are overseen by independent judges.
We've had a Telegram statement following the arrest, and it published it on X, formerly Twitter, says the company abides by EU laws, adding that Pavel Durov has, quote, nothing to hide and travels frequently in Europe. And it goes on to say it's absurd to claim a platform or its owner is responsible for the abuse of that platform. So many questions here. And let's start with what Telegram is, who Pavel Durov is. Doug, you've been looking at this case this week.
Yeah. Pavel Durov in Russia, he's a household name. He's called Pasha. They'll call him Pavel there. He's Pasha. And just about everyone knows him because his real claim to fame was the Vkontakte platform, which was Russia's answer to Facebook, a more regulated, a more restricted version, you might say, of Facebook. He shot to fame on it. And before Vladimir Putin basically started tightening the noose on the internet, on telecommunications, on the media in general. He started to circle the rat wagons around it. And Vkontakte had been a forum for a lot of Ukrainian protest, Ukrainian dissident voices, which was not something to the liking, much to the liking of the Kremlin. He cracked down on that. And Pasha Durov ended up with his brother forming the Telegram platform. But he really had to flee Russia very quickly after founding it because he came under pressure from the Kremlin, this very same Kremlin right now that is jumping to his defense, pouncing to his defense because at the end of the day, Pavel Durov is perhaps more useful to the Kremlin and his platform has become more useful, especially to the Russian army for communications and also, by the way, to the Ukrainian commanders for organizational purposes than the platforms itself and the West and their criticisms of the fact that he is basically trying to set up a free speech platform but abusing that by taking too soft a touch on criminal activity on that platform. So he's a very enigmatic figure. He's an eccentric figure. We've seen him ducking himself in ice tubs, and he leads a very ascetic lifestyle. He's posed, bare-chested and all of that. One of his principles of elite health is to live alone. That's number 7 on his list.
Off-grid, so
he's an eccentric character, but he's complicated. He's very complex, and I think we're just starting to grasp that complexity. But right now, he happens to be at the heart of that debate, right? Where does freedom of speech end, and where does law enforcement begin? And how do you navigate that very fine line?
Why is it always the billionaires that want to live alone, off-grid, with all their security? You've seen it, Ex Machina, you kind of get the idea of that. Philip, now Russia's involved, I'm going to get to there's two different dynamics to this. One is why it matters or might matter to Russia, but there's also why France has become involved in the judiciary here, because, as Doug pointed out, Pavel Durov Pasha moved to the UAE, took UAE citizenship, took also French nationality as well. But there's a question here that the Telegram argue is about, this is about free speech, and he's not culpable, but the French authorities seem to be alluding to the fact that he's not been complying with regulations.
No, and he's been accused of very, very grave things. It's not, it's been broadcasting child pornography, for instance, also allowing for criminal activities to be organized on the platform. It's notorious that this Telegram is one of the biggest platforms for disinformation on Earth, which is a very different thing, but still, and it's also one of the biggest platforms for the military in Russia to communicate between themselves, hence the panic in the Kremlin, by the way. And so the difficulty is that the case is very is criminal at its very base. I mean, he's being sued, he's being charged by the French police because of criminal activity. This is very clear. There's nothing political about that, but it has major political consequences. Since it's a huge disinformation platform, we had what we call the complotist, conspirationists in English, if I'm not wrong.
Conspiracy theory.
That took over and tried to explain his arrest by many, many ludicrous explanations. And there is another aspect, is being, the mandate for his arrest was quite old. He knew he could be arrested if he would come to France. He came nonetheless, which could be an indication that he wanted to be arrested, maybe. We don't know yet if it's not the case. His lawyer is not saying that, but we don't know the truth behind it. Maybe he wanted to escape Russia for very good reasons. He didn't have the best relationship with the FSB, so it could happen that he wanted to be arrested. We don't know that. And the second thing, in Geneva, his family is accusing him of violence, domestic violence. So he's a very complex character indeed. I think that's why Macron immediately said this is not a political affair. This is something else.
But Macron met him at least twice these last years, once in 2018. And the Élysée this week was really reluctant to talk about that. Apparently, they talk about his French citizenship when they met, and then he got it. But the Élysée says, no, it's not us, it's up to the foreign ministry. The foreign ministry kept quiet about that all week. So really, people are really uneasy with that. And where is he? I mean, we need a picture. I mean, is he in Paris, in the Côte d'Azur?
You can't leave France.
Yeah, he can. Yeah, but he has to go to a police office twice a week now, and it's kind of storm in the tech world. Really, it's like Jeff Bezos or Mark Zuckerberg being arrested in France. It's really a big thing.
But I mean, and it is the reason we're talking about this. We haven't seen the arrest of such a high-profile tech platform, tech titan leader. We haven't seen Mark Zuckerberg landing in his private commercial jet and being arrested. We haven't seen any of that. You know, Google's founders, Amazon, nothing. This has not happened yet. The closest you could come is maybe the billionaire Khodorkovsky back in the early 2000s in Russia. He was one of the richest men, if not the richest man in Russia. Putin arrested him. It was sort of the parting salvo in the crackdown on oligarchs who ran foul of the Kremlin. I'll just note one thing. He has a complicated relationship with Putin. It's hard to sort of figure out exactly where it stands right now.
Because there is a counter theory that he met him in Azerbaijan before he came to France.
We don't know. That's all speculation But he has reportedly been back to Russia about 50 times, 50, since he fled into self-imposed exile in 2014.
So, but let me bring in Fraser, because there is a question still ongoing about the establishment of this anti-establishment figure and to what extent he is one. Very briefly, Fraser, Elon Musk has been supporting him. He's got his own problems with Brazil at the moment too.
Yeah, it's not really a surprise that Elon Musk is coming to his defense. Twitter has got into a bit of hot water with the Brazilian authorities. They said that they need to appoint a legal representative of Twitter or it faces being deplatformed in Brazil. And this does speak to that larger question of free speech. And that, of course, is something that the US has contended with as well. If you look at the big one, arguably at the moment, is, of course, TikTok. That has been, at the moment, it's in the process of being banned if it can't get divested to an American-held company. But also the question of encryption also brought up. WhatsApp and Signal, two big messaging apps here in the United States and globally, have all faced these kind of questions from US lawmakers and international lawmakers as well. WhatsApp threatened to pull out of the UK market just last year because the UK was contemplating making it unencrypted as well. So there's a bit of an interesting question here now as to whether these tech platforms are going to come to Telegram's defence or not as well.
Fraser, thank you. There'll be many AP and Reuters journalists in court across France looking for Mr. Durov this week. Will they see him? Definitely. Maybe. That brings us an end to this week. Thank you, Elizabeth Pinault, Philippe Moreau.
We'll be talking about the roses, John.
Next week, possibly.
Next week.
We can live forever and talk about it many more nights. Doug Herbert as well. Stay with us. In 7 days, we'll be back for the world next week.